that I think never takes account of people whose families are spread out around the world. Mm. And the fact is that my daughter is not going to grow up without knowing her grandparents, and her grandparents live in Canada, which means that we have to fly to Canada or they have to fly to London. We can't take a train, right? There's just, the, you know, if there were blips, we'd take blips. It would be probably a lot easier on us as parents to take a blip to Canada, because it's very hard to keep a baby in a plane seat for 9 hours, but we are not going to raise our daughter without seeing her grandparents. That's just, it's just it, you know? And there's no two ways about it.
So one vehicle's love miles.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But you know, I'm I figure, you know, I pay my penance. I'm a vegetarian. I live in a very small, very energy efficient flat with very small, very energy efficient appliances. You know, we have a washing machine that's so small that we can't do an entire, you know, we can't wash our duvet cover in it. We have to hand wash the duvet cover because it won't take that much of a load. Yeah, and it's, you know,
microwave.
Yeah, it's a brand new Miele, high end, super low energy consuming, super low water consuming. You know, so we don't own a car. I've never owned a car. I had a car for 1 year in Los Angeles, but apart from that, I've never owned a car. You know, I'm pretty energy efficient as these things go. You know, we recycle. We recycle the stuff the council doesn't recycle. We save it up, and we take it to the recycling depot to recycle it. So, we're pretty aggressive.
I wasn't going to say anything about your flying. I know we have to file up. I was just wondering about itself. So.
Well, all right. Ready when you are.
Yeah, sort of, she was worried about your rest.
No, I said, if the kids don't show up, I said, well, the talk this evening will be filmed, and we'll say that's it, so you don't have to strain yourself.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess it's one question I was sort of curious about, this regarding copyright. Your stand regarding the motivation factor, the risk of losing motivation factors
for creating material.
Yeah.
I think that almost all the generalizations that you can make about why people make art are visibly untrue in some very substantial cases. So, for example, the exclusive right of authors didn't exist in its current form as we understand it until well into the 17th century. So if it takes the exclusive right of authors to produce works of genuine merit, then what we're really saying is that everything made before the 17th century wasn't very worthy, right? So it's very clear that it is possible for authors to be incentivized to create wonderful works prior to without an exclusive right. So at the same time, the ability to have an exclusive right that you can use as the basis to raise capital for works that exceed an author's ability to capitalize his own material, and that I'm thinking especially these days of film, is unquestionably benefited by an exclusive right, because the exclusive right is something you can take to a capital market. There is clearly a limit to how good that gets. So, for example, if you were to say to best-selling author Stephen King, and say, okay, well, the next book that you produce, instead of getting your life in 70 years, you're going to get your life in 90 years. How much more money will your publisher give you for it? Right, the answer is zero. Right? How many more words will you write? Well, the answer is zero. How much more money will it make for you? The answer is probably zero, because even though Stephen King sells very, very well, odds that he'll probably live another 10 or 15 years. He's in very poor health because he was hit by that truck. But he'll probably live another 10 years, say. So what we're saying is, in the year 2100, what's the commercial fortunes of Stephen King versus the year 2120? And the odds are very slim that between 2100 and 2120, that Stephen King's estate will make any substantial amount of money. So it's clear that somewhere in there is the sweet spot between no exclusive rights and some exclusive rights. There's a sweet spot that incentivizes creativity, and there's a point at which it no longer incentivizes creativity. Now, countervailing that, you have to ask yourself, what do exclusive rights do to other authors who want to make new works? Right. So, if, for example, you want to be a sampling musician, which is probably the best example we have in our modern era, Sampling, being a sampling musician is easy if you work for a music label, because your music, first of all, the odds are 1 in 4 that any composition you want to sample is in your music label's catalog, because there's only 4 music labels. But the other thing is that your music label has reciprocal arrangements, and even if they're not formalized, they're at least customary. So the lawyer from Warner can call up the lawyer from Universal and say, remember that deal we did last week where one of your artists sampled some of my artists? Well, I'd just like to do the deal in reverse. I'll send you the paperwork. I'll cross out your name, write in my name, and vice versa. And it's trivial. If you're an independent artist and you want to do the same thing, you're completely frozen out of this. So what does that do to the motivation of someone who wants to produce work but doesn't want to go into the, either can't satisfy the gatekeepers or doesn't want to come under their thumb? Well, there's clearly this is dispiriting as well. When you're measuring motivation, it's really difficult because, you know, I work with a lot of writing students. I'm mentoring 3 at the University of Waterloo and 3 at the Open University this year. And they get discouraged by lots of things. Exclusive rights are really far down low on the list of things that discourage them. The fact that, you know, I think probably the single most discouraging thing about being a new writer is the dismal economics of being in a craft in which more people want to produce than there are slots to run their material, and in which it takes a very, very long time to get good enough to be publishable. And that's a kind of perfect storm, because for the average writer, you live for 10 or 15 years without any editorial feedback, because your material is not even worth a formal rejection in detail. You know, you probably see manuscripts with the chance of, and most of them you probably just write.
Absolutely.
You send them a form letter, right? So this is incredibly discouraging, right? I don't think that it's your responsibility as an editor to take every unpublishable writer and explain what's wrong with their work to them. But at the same time, if we want to talk about things that demotivate writers, of all the writers I've taught, of all the writers I came up with when I started writing, the single biggest factor that disheartened them was this, right? And then lastly, there's the possibility that an exclusive right can become an offensive weapon. In fact, an exclusive right is an offensive weapon. That's what it's for, right? It's a thing that you can use to exclude people from using the ideas that you generate under its banner. So it's a thing you can use to attack people who violate copyright, what have you. Those exclusive rights, like any weapon, are in any power struggle, are apt to be seized by the person who is most capable of using them. So that, you know, if you ever take a martial arts course, they'll say, any weapon you don't know how to use belongs to your attacker, right? So you have musicians, for example, who get another 45 years of phonogram recordings and phonogram copyrights in Europe, which is what they're proposing. I will predict that within a year of that passing, if it does, that every contract will non-negotiably acquire those 45 years of exclusive rights, those additional 45 years of exclusive rights from those musicians. In patents, it's actually a lot more visible. So if you raise money for a tech company, your venture capitalist will almost certainly insist that you seek out a software patent. Even if you're European, they'll ask you to get an American software patent at least. And they'll tell you that this is so that you'll have a defensible idea. So if someone steals your idea, they can sue. The fact is they've got no interest in litigating your ideas, because in order to do that, they would have to stop production on what you're doing and then spend 10 years and $50 million in a court, right, to win a final victory. This is not going to happen. The old days of detente was HP has 100,000 patents, IBM has 100,000 patents. Neither of them will sue each other because they know that if they do, the other one will find something that the other one's violating and they'll go at it, right? That's not the case if you're an individual entrepreneur. What venture capitalists want your patent for is if your business fails, as 2/3 of all startups do. They want to take your patent and sell it to a litigation firm. And that litigation firm will then go around and sue anyone who tries to do what you're doing and ask them for blood money, like happened with Research in Motion and the BlackBerry. Or Acacia New Media, which is suing everyone who makes streaming media. And so, who is most apt, if your company fails, to be engaged commercially in doing the thing that you invented? It's you, right? That's what serial entrepreneurs do. They do something, it doesn't work, they try it again, right? This is the beauty of bankruptcy laws. You know, this is why we have limited liability corporations. Didn't work this time, we'll try it again. So what this fundamentally means is that whatever you patent for your VCs is something that you won't be allowed to do for 20 years, right, if your company fails. So this is the, so again, you have to look at what's the motivational question associated with being an inventor who, like Moses, is barred from the promised land, right? You can't afford to license your own invention after you leave the firm. You know, and that is, I think, every bit as important in the calculus of how much exclusive rights to give and to whom as anything else. So we could fix, for example, this thing in the patent system by saying you have to be in production on something, on the thing that you have a patent on in order to defend it. And your court would still have to determine whether it's good faith production or it's just a sham. But it would be it's a much simpler legal question to prove, is this person or isn't this person earnestly manufacturing the art covered by the patent, than it is to prove whether or not the patent's a valid patent at all. Right? So again, rather than spending $50 million having a lawyer review the material, you could spend maybe $100,000 having a lawyer settle the question of whether this person's a patent troll or a real earnest manufacturer. So at EFF, we had a patent lawyer who used to do semiconductor litigation for Intel patent lawsuits. And an average lawsuit over a microchip design patent lawsuit would have 1 million documents in evidence. Every one of those documents is reviewed by counsel on both sides at about $300 to $500 an hour. Every single one of the million documents in evidence. So think about the cost of that litigation, right? This is there needs to be a better way to do this than exclusive rights. Yeah, it really does. Really does, right?
You almost convinced them.
Well, so I'm not saying that there isn't a motivation in money. Money is motivating, but it's just not the only motivator, and it can demotivate too.
But also, in Norway, you have this. I think Norway must be one of the best countries to be a writer in, for instance, because we have very good when it comes to grants and everything. Yeah?
This is sort of too interesting not to take sort of. Is it okay if we change on the mic and just roll the tape?
I'm okay with it.
If you're okay with it, okay.
Your stress level is comfortable.
I live in London. I'm recorded all day long. There's 14 CCTVs per red blood cell.
Yeah. No, but I mean, in Norwegian artists and writers, and they're actually paid relatively well, comparatively. For instance, because when you publish a book, it's automatically bought by the state and distributed to all the libraries. Mm-hmm. So if you publish this book had been published in Norwegian, written in Norwegian in the first place, it would be distributed in 1,550 copies up to all the libraries, which pays better, which makes the authors.
Sure, yeah, it's a subsidy.
So, yeah, it's a subsidy, and I think Norwegian authors and artists in general, when they talk about these things, money is quite a big issue, because quite a few actually live off this work, and they're able to, in a way that artists by their relatively small size wouldn't be able to.
The Canadian distributor for Tor is Fenn. And Fenn buys Tor hardcovers on a non-returnable basis. And every Canadian writer sells a minimum threshold of copies into the Canadian library system. And so for a long time, Tor had a real preference to buying Canadian first novelists because they knew that they could guarantee a minimum order big enough to pay the production costs and that it would be a non-returnable order that they could show it on their books immediately without any withholdings. So just like, you know, we sold it to Fenn, that's it, right? Yeah. Harold Fenn can't return them. They're yours now. Yeah. You know? And that was, it worked really well. It's funny how a subtle piece of policy like that can make a huge difference in the cultural landscape of a country.
And for the Norwegians, I mean, it's really important to do in Norway as well, because we're such a small language. I mean, you said that more people speak Norwegian in the Midwest than in Norway.
Yeah.
And actually, it turns out that because of this very aggressive policy in order to make more Norwegian books, it turns out that people prefer to read Norwegian as well.
Mm.
So in a sense, it's sometimes I think that Norwegians should have read more English books or non-translated as well, because you know all this.
Yeah, you can see it from the bestseller list or the best read list from the libraries.
Right.
It's just Norwegian books.
Wow.
If you go to Sweden, for example, there are a lot of English and American writers on top of the list.
Sure.
In Norway, always, always just Norwegian writers.
And Swedes, because we love Sweden. Sweden don't right. love us, but we love them.
Yeah, yeah. You got traded to Denmark, right? Like a prisoner being traded for two packs of cigarettes.
Well, the other way, actually. We traded from Denmark to Sweden.
Oh,
yeah.
From Denmark
yeah.
to Sweden,
yeah.
That's right.
So I don't know why we love them. It's
no, it's like the Finns. They don't know why they love the Swedes
yeah.
either.
No.
That's right.
But if you
I think the aristocracy.
Excuse me, sorry.
No, that's okay.
Well, if you want to put the leg over Swede in a little offensive way, say them that the way Norwegians look at Swedes is they are Germans with a human face. And they go,
oh, stiff. Oh, that's terrible. I actually heard a Norwegian joke the first time I was here, and it was that it was what happens if a child trips and skins their knee in different Scandinavian countries? And in Sweden, they strike a committee to eliminate knee skinning. In Denmark, they give him a cuddle. And in Norway, they give him a smack and tell him to stop crying. This was a joke from a Norwegian.
Well, it's very good on the Swedes, actually. They have committees for everything.
Yes.
They're very...
I don't feel. I will be heading back to my office to get some work done. And then come back
yeah.
here at
I
5 o'clock.
We'll follow you down to the hotel.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah.
And you'll be back by the evening.
Yeah.
If that's where the big...
Okay,
yeah.
So we'll go back to hotel now instead.
Yeah, we can I mean,
yeah.
it's up to you guys.
No, I think you should be able to rest and do what you have to do. And
mm-hmm.
I'm giving a speech in Canada on Thursday, and there's a French translation. They've just told me the translators want the speech written out, and I never write out my speeches, so I have to go and write out an hour and a half long speech that I was going to give up.
Sure.
Just
one
yeah.
question before we
yeah.
show. Paper-wise, newspaper-wise,
mm-hmm.
sort of have you any opinions on that market and the mechanism there?
Well, so a lot of the problems I think the newspaper industry are experiencing now is really the long-term impact of decisions they made 20 years ago when they eliminated a lot of the in-house news gathering and started to rely much more heavily on news wires. And I think that the use of news wires was very difficult to detect when all you had were your local papers. But as soon as the papers all went on the web, and you realized that if you search for a news story that you read this morning in your daily paper, that you found 50 copies of it in 50 daily papers across America, then it started to seem a little odd, right? What do we need these 50 newspapers for if really all they do is reproduce newswire copy? And then you realize that a lot of the stuff that appears in the newswire, not all of it, but a large amount of it, is covered very well in first-hand accounts, which also show up largely on the web. So it's like, well, so it's not like local newspapers don't do anything, and it's not like newswires don't do anything, but a huge amount of what they do is being done by the web, more or less for free, as an externality of other activities, normal activities. And where I think, you know, John Stewart did a really funny bit on newspapers, where he sent a reporter to the New York Times to meet with the head editor, and he said, so tell me the value of aged news. And the editor was like, well, I don't understand what you mean by aged news. And he said, well, here's today's New York Times. Yeah. Everything in here happened yesterday, right? Well, yes. So it's not really news anymore. It's aged news. So, well, yes. You know. And it's true, right? It is aged news. But you know, I write new news and aged news. I write for newspapers, and I write for blog. And the blog stuff that I write tends to be quick, impressionistic, and it's like, here are 100 things that cross my transom that I'm thinking about today. And the columns tend to be long and synthetic, and it's like, here is what I've put together, having thought about those 100 things all week, here's what I've synthesized out of them. And I think that as synthetic, venues for synthetic thought, for longer, more thoughtful synthetic pieces, newspapers are really well suited to it. And this is, I think, one of the reasons that we love our weekend newspapers, right? Because we love to lie down on the sofa. I did this yesterday, 5.5 hours. My wife and I are members of a little club in London. We spent 5.5 hours on the sofa, taking turns taking care of the baby, going swimming, and then when the baby was sleeping, reading a stack of London weekend newspapers this tall, And the stuff that was interesting were the synthetic pieces. Yep. The long, thoughtful pieces. Not the stuff that I'd already heard in 30-second news bites on the radio that week or read about, you know, in my RSS reader, but like someone putting it all together. It's relaxing, it's stimulating, it's all of that. And I think that newspapers have a future to the extent that they embrace the thing that they're good at. But the special pleading of newspapers, in which they characterize themselves as nonpartisan, unstintingly accurate, the only people who really tell you the news as it is, the only source of real news coverage, all of this stuff, it's just not true. I don't think it was ever true. I think it's kind of a noble myth, right? Because when you look into the history of the American news media and the British news media, it was all started and run by political parties. Right? They were not nonpartisan. They were totally partisan, right? There were Democrat and Republican newspapers. The reason that we call the Telegraph the Torygraph is because the Conservative Party has basically used the Telegraph as a mouthpiece for decades.
Well, it's the same thing in Norway.
I'm sure it is. Yeah, absolutely. In Austria, you know, where newspapers are really widely read. Austria is like, I think, the most newspaper-reading place I've ever been. Those newspapers are totally identified with political parties. So they're not nonpartisan. And, you know, if you've ever seen a newspaper article about something that you're an expert in, you read it and you think, my God, they got that wrong. How can they get everything else so right, but the thing that I know about wrong? And after a couple of these, you realize, in fact, they only get it right in the broad strokes. That you know, they're on a daily production cycle, and they are not going to get it right in that depth that you look to. They'll get some stuff right, like a newspaper, restaurant reviewer for a local paper will do an amazing job. But the science reporter for the newspaper is never going to be as good as Nature magazine, you know, just ever. So, you know, I think that when we clear the air of the special pleading and the appeals to emotion and sentiment, what we end up with is newspapers do some things well, the web does some things well, newspapers do some things poorly, the web does some things poorly. Newspapers' business model have been harmed not by Google, but by classified advertising moving into the web, and by the fact that the value of a newspaper has declined radically in a world in which you can see exactly how much newswire copy is being replicated, and where you can get first-hand accounts of so much of this stuff. So once we get to that point and we start to say to ourselves, okay, how can we rescue the stuff that newspapers are good at doing? Not how can we rescue the New York Times, not how can we rescue the Guardian, but how can we rescue those social functions? Then I think we'll find some good answers. But so long as the question is how can we ensure that something about this big made of dead trees is dropped on your doormat every morning, I don't think we will have an answer to that.
Just a short. I don't. Have you seen any models that sort of sounds the right way?
Well, so there are a couple of really interesting experiments in citizen journalism I've admired. One commercial, one non-commercial. So non-commercial was a writer who's actually a friend of mine named John McDade, who's a very highly regarded science fiction writer. But he lives in a small town in Rhode Island, in New England, it hasn't had a local newspaper in decades. And it's, like every small town, a hotbed of local news. There's fights over, you know, funding, you know, there's police department issues, there's, you know, council elections, there's the way the schools are run, all of that. And John became active as a citizen, going to a lot of these meetings, and he started taking notes, and then he started blogging it. And then he became the single most important and trusted source of local news in his small town in Rhode Island. And he's got members of Congress who weigh in his blog comments, he's got the mayor, he's got the police chief, everyone is part of this discussion. And it's totally non-commercial, and it's an externality of the fact that he was just civically minded. And, you know, these were the notes he was taking for his own benefit that he started to put on the web that then accumulated or accrued a community around it. And then the other one is the South Korean Oh My News. Which is, a citizen journalism paper that has a small paid staff that synthesizes material that's submitted by the general public and has an ad sales department that goes out and sells the ads. And they're responsible, as I understand it, for a massive reversal in Korean politics where a long-term incumbent was thrown out, a very unlikely underdog was elected, and the first visit paid by the official new PM was to Oh My News. Right? That was his first official interview. So clearly, it works some places, and I think we probably you know, I think that a lot, that when we say newspapers, we picture a monolithic thing that's done the same way everywhere, and it's just not, right? You know, the New York Times business model is radically different from a Norwegian daily. You know, for one thing, no one's buying the International Herald Tribune with articles from the Norwegian daily, right? Whereas the New York Times has an enormous ancillary source of revenue licensing at the internet to the IHT, and to the Guardian and to everyone else. You know, all of that stuff is totally different. And when you get into the newspapers of states that are way more interventionist and authoritarian, like, you know, the China Daily, the China Daily's business model is totally unrelated to the New York Times business model. You know, so I just think that it's a mistake to try and lump all newspapers in together and say, what will save all newspapers?
Okay.
All right.
See you this evening.
Thank you very
much. Yeah, and... Yeah, let's do it.